right, welcome back to another edition of the Sunstone Podcast. I'm your host, John Larson. We're here again in the fabulous Sunstone Studios in the Marmalade District of Salt Lake City. A couple of brief announcements at the top. We've got a lot of good fun activities coming up here in a little bit. I'd love to have you join Lindsay and myself. First of all, we're going to be in Short Creek on April 26th. It's a great opportunity to come down to that community, a community people usually don't get to. Colorado City, the old stomping ground of Warren Jeffs. We're going to be staying in some of the compounds down there, helping with a service project and having a few talks and some giggles. It'll be a lot of fun. The weekend after that, we'll be in Kirtland, Ohio. We'll be trucking around the temple and trucking around the city. There's a Sunstone conference there. If you're going to be anywhere in the Midwest, I would suggest you come on over and see us. And we just announced on June 21st, this of course is the last year the church will be running the Manti Mormon Miracle Pageant that's been running for, I don't even know how long. One of the great last items of Mormon kitsch, and it's there and it's going away. So we are there on the penultimate night, June 22nd will be the last time they do this ever. So we're going to be taking a bus down from Salt Lake City. The bus will be hosted by myself and by Lindsay. We'll have trivia. We'll have a lot of fun. We're going to go down. We're going to have dinner in one of the steak centers. We're going to record a live podcast, and we're going to watch the show. So I would suggest the bus is going to fill up quickly. Get your tickets and come down and join us. You ever been down to the Mormon Miracle Pageant, Harv?
Once.
How long ago?
Oh, it's been decades.
It's been since the 80s for me. So my grandparents used to live in Manti, so it was just part of my heritage, and I'm looking forward to going back. All right, so we're here tonight talking to Harvard, who has just produced or edited or what's the best word for what you've done?
Edited is fine.
a great collection of the the diaries of David O. McKay. So first, before we get into that, David O. McKay is a fascinating character to me, and I love the lore around him. I love his bifurcated nature, and we're going to get into all that. But what got you interested in this? How did you get to here? What's your background?
Well, first of all, I was he was the only prophet that I knew. In fact, as a young man, I believe I might have shaken his hand at a general conference back in the early 50s. So he was kind of my prophet that I recall growing up, and his impact was immense in my life as a role model of how one approaches life, marriage, family. And I was always impressed with him. And I was had come back to school and was woken up by a call, but my father's president had died in January of 1970. And I thought, what a tremendous man. I did not realize at that time that my intersection with his life would be rather serendipitous. In about 1970, when he died, shortly thereafter, there was the resignation of Ernest Wilkinson. And that was not coincidental.
Oh, really?
Both deaths were related because he knew the jig was up. Once President McKay died, he had lost his support among the quorum. And all the problem then arose after they had had a search committee and found Elder Oaks. They had a problem on their hands. How do we take care of President Wilkinson, who's on campus, who's been here for 20 years? How do we keep him out of trouble? And the idea was, hey, we've got a centennial history coming up in 1975. Let's put him in charge of research and writing the centennial history. I was a young undergraduate, and they had decided to hire a couple of graduate students to help with the research and writing. And I had a couple of wonderful professors who forcefully pushed me into that mix and got me hired to be on that President Wilkinson project. During that time, we began to go to Salt Lake, and this was the years prior to Camelot, in which a lot of collections were closed, and we met with a lot of problems of getting into records in the, I think it was 1972 and 73, and President Wilkerson found that his old nemesis, Elder Lee, was probably behind this because they did not get along. And President Wilkerson commented, well, he might not live forever. And sure enough, President Lee passed away 4 months later. So we reapplied for these records and got them. And during this process, we were allowed to see President McKay's diary. This was just after Arrington had been hired and the years of Camelot had begun. And so I went up there as a young student and thought this diary of President McKay was absolutely marvelous. I tried to be honest and only look at stuff that related to BYU history, but I couldn't help reading other things. And I thought, you know, someday I'm going to come back and go through this again because there's so much stuff here. So I did my job and looked for BYU-related material and thought, when I get through and get into my graduate work, I'm going to come back here. Little did I realize that Camelot would soon end and those were closed. So I thought, I'll never see the McKay Diaries ever again. And then serendipity, I made some contacts and found that Greg Prince was doing a biography, or I should say administrative history of President McKay. Contacted him, and through he and his longtime friend who got him into the diaries, Robert Wright, I got access to the diaries again, and I talked Bob Wright into letting me use them. He was at this time suffering early Alzheimer's and was concerned about whether we should do this because he thought that Greg Prince and his work would be sufficient for President McKay. I tried to explain to him the importance of diaries and having those out in addition too. So finally, I got his consent to do that. And with the help of Gary Bergera and Smith Pettit, signed a contract to do the abridgment in their diary series. I had previously done the same type of work on Reed Smoot, the Apostle Senator, and edited his diaries. As it turned out, I began to see some problems arising with this situation with Bob Wright. And I was able to talk him into meeting with the University of Utah with Greg Thompson to perhaps make a donation of the diaries to the University of Utah. They had a pretty good collection already of President McKay stuff. And he was very much in favor of that. And I pushed it very hard. And within a couple of weeks, we had that deal done. And they were deposited at the University of Utah. However, after that, I think he had some second thoughts about me doing that for some reason. Not sure what that was. I liked Bob a lot. He was a great guy. I wish I had known Bob when he was with his full faculties because he was a superb lawyer, mission president, and just a really great guy. So when they got to the U, I had heard that he was starting to get cold feet about the project. And so, I'll leave some names out here. A member of the Utah staff says, hey, he's raising some problems here. So I just told Mr. Wright that now they're in our possession and they're open to research and Harvard would have access to them. So during this process, through the help of Gary Bergera and Smith Pettit, they helped me with the permission of University of Utah to make a photocopy so I'd have to work with on the McKay's diary. Then the problem began to occur, which I had experienced previously with Smoot. You've got so much material. How do you abridge that in a way that will be representational of the person's life? If you only highlight the interesting good parts, then people begin to assume that that's all there is. And this concern I experienced with the McKay diary, when you read the table of contents, you'll see chapter headings that indicate, well, this year he talks only about this. Was that what was most important? Was that really the really important issues of that year? Yes and no. I had to, for example, this book has about some 800 pages of his diary, and the binders which I used by Claire Middlemiss were over 100, and for example, one binder might contain only 3 months, maybe 300 pages, and just for a partial year. So one can imagine how much I had to leave out. However, to be fair, Middle Miss also included in the diaries newspaper clippings that pertain to President McKay or the activities of that day. She also would include letters that were part of the week that he might have had a conversation with somebody. So she had a lot of extraneous material that wasn't diary related. So it kind of enlarged the total situation.
So she was controlling these.
She was.
Now, there's a lot that you've just given there, and it's fascinating, and it's really fascinating for me to be right here with you because this has always been sort of ancient history to me. Let's go back and unpack some of this stuff that you're talking about, because we have some people listening here. You're throwing out really important names that everyone should know, but I'm afraid that they don't. So let's level set. David O. McKay was the president of the church from 1951 to 1970. And he'd been in the quorum since what?
1906.
And you know, we look at the number of presidents of the church we've had. When you actually collapse them down, you have these administrative reigns. You know, like the Hinckley years. Hinckley was, of course, very close to Harold B. Lee, and then, of course, to Spencer Kimball. And then, so, you know, the Hinckley years are like 40 years. And really, predecessing reign was David O. McKay, because he was in that chair for a long, long time.
Yeah, President Grant was longer. What's interesting, you bring up President McKay. Like I said, he was the president of my youth, but you got to think about President McKay. He was born in 1873. That's 3 years before Custer's last stand. I mean, we were still fighting the Sioux Indians when he was born. And so by 1923, he's 50 years old.
I've often called that period that he reigned over sort of the golden age of Mormonism. When you take the 50s and 60s, we sort of hit our stride. Our marriage of Americana and Christianity just dovetailed right in with the American ethos. And he sort of reigned over that period.
I would say also, though, John, I agree with you on that, but I would say that there was also a golden age in the 1920s.
Yes.
This is when you have the old guard dying off. I mean, you have James Talmage, you have Stephen R. Richards, you have B.H. Roberts still there, you have Adam S. Benyon.
O.C. Tanner.
Yeah, and these people who were called into the church service and were working with the church on other projects were these educators that were kind of progressive. They wanted to, like you say, integrate and assimilate into American culture. After the Smoot hearings, we wanted to get away from that image of being this provincial little cult.
Absolutely. And if you can get your hands on the Sunday school manuals from the 20s, they're fascinating. They're full of poetry and secular literature. And there was really sort of an embracing, I think in a very healthy, positive way, of American world culture.
And President Grant, in some ways, was a damper on that. But Anthony W. Ivins kept things lively and was very open-minded and, by all accounts, very liberal. But with the ascension of President Clark in the first presidency and then President McKay, you began to have what I think Orrin Moss has called one of the retrenchment periods. And President McKay, as second counselor, was left kind of in the background. And during the illness of President Grant and also George Albert Smith, President Clark kind of ran the church. He would always go by President Grant's office or home and explain what was being done and get his permission. But he was kind of running the show. So President McKay was in the background. So in 51, when he becomes president, and the tumultuous experience, which I mentioned in the book, of the change of position in the first presidency with his friend coming in as first counselor, Stephen L. Richards, and President Clark being now the second counselor, was quite tumultuous. We always hear this story, that this famous quote by President Clark: "It's not doesn't matter where you serve, how you serve."
Mm-hmm.
Not so true. He was deeply offended by that and was hurt by that, and that comes out somewhat in the diaries, but more. Mike Quinn has explored that very extensively in his book on J. Rupert Clark. So President McKay comes into this new era. And like you said, John, he's trying to integrate the post-war period with all that was going on. trying to keep the church ahead of the challenges, but at the same time trying to maintain a certain tradition and certain ideas that he wanted to keep in the forefront of our culture and theology. And it was a very trying time, and hence the title of the book. He was trying to maintain this confidence amidst unbelievable change.
It was a huge time of change. And you know, when we talk about a charismatic leader of the church, people today think of Gordon Hinckley. But it's hard to talk too little about how much of a dynamic figure he was. He had this great big head of hair, and he was clean-shaven. I think he was the first one who was completely clean-shaven.
Yeah, I mentioned in my book, he's a prophet of firsts.
Yes.
And perhaps the most important first is he's the first president of the church with a blue blood background.
He wasn't from one of the big families.
No, he was a grandson of a Scottish convert living in Huntsville, Utah. His dad was nothing. So he's non-blue blood. And before you have the George Albert Smith, who's related to everybody, Heber J. Grant has everybody's his cousin.
Right.
And Joseph Smith, who's the first prophet to come from a non-blue blood background. First clean-shaven person. The first person to really be able to say, this is what marriage is all about. Romance. You can't talk about romance with polygamy very easily.
Right, right.
And President Grant, he had a good marriage, but he was sickly. And George Albert Smith had a wonderful marriage. But President McKay, in our time, was this model of
what
it should
be. He had no connection in his family to polygamy, not really.
No, he didn't. But like you say, the thing that really got to most people, non-members as well as members, was this charismatic, handsome. He was a big man with that flowing white hair. And he just, as many people commented, if there is a person who ought to be a prophet that looks like a prophet, it's David O. McKay. This comes from non-members, diplomats. And he was just so charismatic, and we haven't really had that.
No.
And you don't want to rank prophets because that's always in bad taste. But he was that dynamic, handsome personality who just exuded confidence and this kind of gentleman attitude, yet not buttoned up. He was kind of out there as a man who was of the world. He read extensively, loved literature. And when you read his talks, they're full of quotes from literature.
And he was a conflicted person himself, not necessarily in a really negative way. And we'll get to that in a minute. But what I really liked about him is that he would wear white suits and light gray suits. Like, nobody does that. And he would do it all the time. And you would see, because of his shocking white hair, he almost looked like he had an aura around him, like he glowed.
The white suit was the famous trademark. And one of the things that Greg Prince mentions in one of his interviews, his kids said he had two vanities. First one was he liked to drive big cars and drive them fast. And the second was he loved his long hair. And at times, I think it bothered his wife. He let those flowing locks. But it was so handsome. And my parents, my mother sort of thought he was the most handsome man she'd ever seen. And when he spoke, it was something.
Yeah,
it was special.
He was a dynamic speaker.
Hi, I'm Lindsay Anson Park, Executive Director of the Sunstone Education Foundation. I want to invite you to our weekly Sunstone Firesides. Do you remember those? Firesides that they used to have dating all the way back to the 1930s, when the LDS Church would hold monthly meetings to discuss really important gospel topics. Those meetings became known endearingly as Firesides. In January of 2019, Sunstone launched a new podcast that incorporates a nod to these firesides. Featuring a weekly evening podcast, it will display a range of hosts, all women, as they chat with diverse guests from across the Mormon spectrum. The hosts are all female-identifying that represent a broad perspective in Mormonism. These podcasts will be released every Thursday evening, so you can have that fireside feel brought right into your living room. So grab a cup of cocoa or coffee, since at Sunstone there is more than one way to Mormon. Snuggle up under a blanket and listen to incredible interviews by and from incredible people. You can support women and their work in Mormon studies, which is desperately needed, by donating at sunstone.org or becoming a monthly subscriber. Go to sunstone.org and click on the podcast tab for more info. We hope you enjoy it as much as we do.
So we're talking, and you can read, I'm glad you mentioned Greg Prince, because I also want to get into how Greg got papers and the connection to there. But he was sometimes in the camp of Benson and Ernie Wilkinson and that really kind of right-wing sort of political era. And then he would give lip service to the, or he, not lip service, he would kind of balance back and forth between these two. So we talked about Arrington. I just really want to define that period of Camelot. During these years, the church really opened up historical, and that's when you, as an undergraduate, were able to get these. When you talk about Camelot, we usually use that word to refer to this period before there became a crackdown, and the church really just closed the archives off. And folks like you and D. Michael Quinn and Leonard Arrington were able to do a bunch of research at the time and have access to things that we lost for decades.
Yeah, well, I'm not in the same category as Mike Quinn. He saw lots and was smart enough to make copies. I was dumb and uninformed. I thought I'd go back to it. When you mentioned John about the spectrum with the political spectrum with Benson and Wilkinson, that's a very complicated situation. He was conservative, and we all need to recognize right up front, he was part of that famous division of statehood where he was on the wrong side of the congregation when they announced Democrats and Republicans. And hence Gunn McKay, who's his second or third cousin, uh-huh. was caught on the other side of the aisle, and he was a longtime Democrat, as were his kids to this day. So he was raised Republican, and he was conservative like most people were, but he wasn't the Benson conservative. And you'll read the diary where he has to, unfortunately, take on Ezra Taft Benson on some of his political issues. And President McKay did not like confrontation.
No.
And so he would try to kind of cajole or gently coerce Elder Benson to stop doing what he was doing. But Elder Benson never could do it. And so you'll find there, time after time, year after year, he keeps pushing the envelope, and President McKay has to pull him back. But there were members of the quorum who were upset at this right-wing deal and fought against it, so he had allies. But Wilkinson is a case in point. What's important for people to realize, he was right-wing as they come, but his relationship with President McKay made possible the BYU of today. When he became president, he went to President McKay's office and said, they came in the same year, 51, and President McKay says, thank you for coming, but you should realize you weren't my first choice to be president of BYU. And he said, I wanted someone else. Well, I'm going to try and get your respect, President McKay. So Wilkinson was a smart enough politician and pretty shrewd, and in some ways kind of unethical in that when they went to the board meetings to make proposals, and Wilkinson had these charts and graphs, why we need more buildings, why we need to have more students, why we need to hire this and that, the board always voted him down. Sometimes it was overwhelmingly, 8-2, 9-0. And so Wilkinson would leave the meeting, walk across the street to President McKay's apartment and say, we have a problem. I got voted down on this. I'll take care of it, Ernest. I'll take care of it. And so that was the buildup of resentment against President Wilkinson among core members. And so over that time period, President McKay and President Wilkinson did things that today would be unheard of for a president of BYU to go behind the board's back to the uh-huh. prophet and say, we're going to do this. And so in that way, right-wing as Wilkinson was and as dictatorial as he was, he intentionally built BYU to what is today, maybe for the wrong reasons, maybe, but he did it with President McKay's help. And one of President McKay's greatest assets was his love for education and yeah. wanted to make BYU a reputable institution.
Well, and I think there's one last loose end we need to tie up here, and that's Claire Middlemiss, which is probably for you, dear listener, the most powerful person in Mormonism you've never heard of. Claire, and definitely probably the most powerful woman in Mormonism ever. Claire was David O. McKay's personal secretary, and she was a personal secretary for like four or five. Was she with Grant before McKay?
No, she came in as President McKay's secretary in 1935.
Okay. But then she stayed on for the next four presidents of the church, I think.
This is the strange thing. You mentioned her, and you're exactly right. She is a remarkable woman. She thought that at the time of his ascendancy to the presidency that she would be let go, and they'd bring in a male secretary. And President McKay says, "Don, I want to keep you, Claire." And that's the first time and the last time that'll ever happen in the church. And she was devoted to President McKay. She never married. She was a very good typist and knew how to manage the office. And over the years, she actually was kind of the palace guard.
Yes, and Greg Prince in his book talks about this quite a bit, and you can read about it everywhere else, but she was the gatekeeper, and as his health started to decline, you very much had to persuade Claire if you wanted to talk to David O. McKay. And some of this palace intrigue we're talking about comes about as people were trying to do end runs around the 12 and get in good favor of Claire so they could get directly to David.
And sad to say, as you well know, Claire Middlemiss was a aunt to Robert Wright. And so she left her estate to Bob Wright, who he was, again, a senior partner in one of the biggest law firms in Salt Lake. Didn't have time to get to it, but he found it there, copies of the diaries, all kinds of papers. And because of that relationship, Bob Wright got them, and Claire was probably, I don't know, I'm just speculating, hoping they would somehow see the light of day.
So Claire never, she had all these papers. She had control of all this stuff, and she never gave it to the church history department.
Well, she was allowed, I mean, this is speculation. I would say that President McKay knew that there was another copy being kept, and there is no evidence that President McKay said either way, but I think there was a tacit understanding that she could have a copy to keep. And this is, again, my speculation. There were stories told that she was approached. I know Bob Wright was approached to give his copies up. And it's important to know that Claire, as loyal and as great as she was with President McKay, she engendered serious problems with other members of the quorum, and she was let go.
Well, she
right after he died, she was let go.
She didn't have the sausage was made. I mean, yeah, this is a woman who was inside all that stuff.
But they didn't want to have somebody who, like you said, who is the gatekeeper, keep that. And usually they would, in most cases, they'll rehire secretaries to the brethren. And she was let go. And Bob Wright, I guess we can say this, Bob Wright told me that the president had given her a generous pension, mm-hmm. and they reneged on that. And Bob Wright would have said that we can enter a legal suit to get that back. And she says, "No, it's not worth it to me to let it go." So she was treated rather shabbily. And on this point, I'll let this go. When I was doing my research, I thought, I wonder if I could get some help with some of the papers in the legal papers with the. So I called up a friend of mine whose son worked in the church law firm and said, "Could you just ask around if I could, is there any Claire Middlemiss papers?" And I got back a reply next week. Says, "Let me tell you, Howard, she weighs heavy here still, and her name is not mentioned here. There'll be no help coming from this office." So they were well aware of the power she had, and I feel bad that she was so unfairly treated when she left. And I think she died in 1986, so it was quite a time after she left that job. So, yeah, she is, as you say, one of the most important figures in church history that's never talked about.
So when you go through these journals, how much of it is in McKay's handwriting versus Middlemiss?
Well, this is the question. It's all typed. And so we assume that most cases later on was dictated. And she was very meticulous. She'd go home at night and obviously do this. I mean, it was a lifetime job for her. She never took vacations and typed this. And when he would go on a trip without her, she would require somebody keep an account each day of what happened. If he went to Europe or South America, wherever he went. And so she was meticulous in making sure that something was kept every day about what he was doing. And the question arises from critics, how much of this is Middlemiss's paraphrasing?
Right.
Is this literal?
Which is the problem we had with Katie Carter. Katie Carter, of course, as the founding director and ruled with a hand, an iron fist, the Daughters of Utah pioneers. And it's a well-known secret among all historians that she deleted or burned or threw away a lot of stuff. So what is the verdict on Claire?
I think she was pretty honest in what she did. I don't think the only time that she would maybe paraphrase was towards the end. You'll find the diary where he became ill. She would insert some of Alvinard Dyer's diary entries in place of President McKay's when he was ill. And of course, she was a second cousin to Alvinard Dyer, and which also was a connection to get through the gate.
And Dyer was a prolific writer at the time. He just churned stuff out.
He did. And he was not too popular with some of the members of the quorum, which is why when President McKay died, he was never put in the quorum.
And this is a point I want to emphasize. During this period, the quorum was deeply divided about many things, both politically and the direction of the church, things like what Henry D. Moyle was doing with his building campaign. They're very good now at presenting a face that they're unified. And this was a time there wasn't, I assume they loved and respected each other, at least to some degree. I mean, there was some shenanigans that went on with Hubie Brown and stuff like that. But they were not a monolith.
I think that Mike Quinn in his book has a nice little discussion of the McKay men and the Clark men and the quorum.
Yes.
And the problem was in the 60s, when the politics became very animated, like today, very partisan, you were coming off the McCarthy and hearings and all this communist stuff. Somehow, President McKay wanted to be neutral and aloof from this, but he couldn't avoid it. Like you mentioned, there are those in the quorum who were this way and that way. One of the funny stories in the diary is during the 64 election, a letter had come out. I believe was got some involved with some kind of state president here and a Dutch church member. A letter endorsing Goldwater. And so this got out, and President Brown and the first press, he says, well, we got to stop this. Let's get this letter back and get rid of it. And Grant Richards, who was, of course, a former president of the Dutch mission, said, well, it's already out. It's too late for that. But we all want Goldwater anyway, don't we? So you see the sentiment there. And I think the President McKay tried to keep the lid on the political problems, but he really couldn't. And one of the problems that we see in church history is, especially in contemporary church history, those that talk the most and write the most get seen and listened to the most and read the most by church members. And people who have a lot to say, bright, intelligent minds, don't write or don't speak out. And even President McKay, a lot of his great stuff that in the diary were things that we wish he would have said publicly, such as marriage is not a doctrine, it's a policy. And any man who has one wife will have just as much chance thereafter as a man with many wives. That's not a doctrinal thing. And with relation to African-Americans, he also stressed that was a policy. But those things never got out. What got out was the Joseph Fielding Smith, Bruce R. McConkie stuff. And of course, the biggest thing that people always want to talk about is the famous deal in the diary of the Mormon Doctrine episode, in which that was never made public. So people assumed that the republication of Mormon doctrine was okay with everybody in Salt Lake. And, you know, it is what it is, Mormon doctrine.
So let's give the background to that story a little bit. Bruce R. McConkie, who was, we talk about the big Mormon families, he was tied in 14 ways till Thursday of the legacy that came down from Joseph F. Smith, who was, of course, the first big church historian, who wrote the first Mormon doctrine book back in 1903, I think it was. And then he published this book, Mormon Doctrine, which was a staple of the church all the time I was growing, until the church de-emphasized it only like, what, 6 or 7 years ago.
Yeah, I thought it was when I grew up, my dad had the first edition, and I read it a lot.
I have my first edition. I love that book.
And I thought it was the fifth standard work.
And it was treated that way. During the 80s, it was treated. I mean, people would take it on their missions with them. But he published this first edition, and it had some things that were problematic for the church, particularly the elements about African-Americans He went full on arguing, you know, the blood of Cain and all that stuff. And the second big problematic area was his rhetoric on the Catholic Church, which they toned down.
Yeah, this is a surprise. Now, this is one of the complexities. I'll just take a little side bar here on the Catholic Church. He stated one time in his diary, the two greatest threats to America today are communism and Catholicism. And yet, his good friend, Dwayne Hunt, the bishop in Salt Lake, they were good friends.
Uh-huh.
And I think that that animosity towards the Catholic Church goes back to that Huntsville monastery that was put there in 1948.
You think? I've always figured it just went back to 19th century. I mean, in Joseph Smith's time, then 30s and 40s.
Popish conspiracy.
It was very anti-Catholic. I mean, yeah. And you can even look back when Kennedy was running. There was still a huge amount of anti-Catholicism in the United States.
But Mormon doctrine, the thing that I discovered here, which was a little troubling, was, and this I got some up from the Clark papers, when this came about, and they called it Joseph Fillion Smith and Bruce R. McConkie to talk about it, Joseph Fillion said, I knew nothing about what he was doing, which I find incredulous.
And Joseph Fielding was his father-in-law.
Father-in-law, yeah. And the person who helped edit the book was Joseph Fillion's son and Bruce R.'s good friend. So for this to be kept in the dark is bizarre. And the fact that I think that who was it? David Berger wrote an article one time that showed that a large percentage of the Mormon doctrine goes back to Joseph Fillion's publications. So sounds strange that he didn't know anything about it.
I've read them both, and it's clear to me that the Mormon doctrine that Bruce R. wrote was just an extension of his family's work. It is just a continuation.
And the complication with this, which I was rather astonished to see, was Bruce R. McConkie was very... meek about the rebuke. He took it and said, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done it. I apologize. What can I do to make amends? But then I found out that 3 years earlier, he had written a book in my senior moments here, I can't recall the title of it, Sound Doctrine, I think it was. He wrote a book using the Journal of Discourses. And J. Reuben Clark in... must have been November of about 57 or 56, gets this flyer from Bookcraft saying, for Christmas, be sure you order your new book by Bruce R. McConkie, Sound Doctrine. And Brother Clark says, I never heard this going on. Neither President McKay. So he asked for a copy to be brought to his office from Bookcraft. He read about 100 pages, says, call in Bruce R. right now. So the story goes, he says, what have you done here? Why didn't you clear that was the brother? And this is, I read these 100 pages. It's horrible and I don't want it published. Okay, I'm sorry. Well, come see us and talk about these kind of things. Yeah, I know I should have. I really should have, but I didn't. So that got scrapped. But then 2 years later, he's doing the same thing. Huh. He's writing Mormon Doctrine the same way. And I'm not sure what was behind all that. It was kept secret, but Press McKay in the diary put on two apostles, Marky Peterson, I think it was Marion Jerome, to review it. This was back in March, I think, of 59. And in 1960, in January, they held a meeting. And as you mentioned, they found like 1,067 errors in it. And so he was asked to no longer publish it, and they're going to take it off the shelves. But then... it got republished again 4 years later, which is another story in itself, how that was done.
The revised.
Yeah. And I'm not sure how much we want to talk about this. We let this go, but there's some more interesting stories about how that got redone. And you mentioned, John, it was just, 5 or 6 years ago that it was taken off the shelves and will never be published again.
It has gone down the memory hole.
It's gone forever. And I think everybody breathed a sigh of relief.
It's a really interesting book, and it's one that I've spent a lot of time with thinking about, both as a faithful member and then as I've gone through my faith transition, because it is a very clear enumeration of what people actually believe in the church. But some of it, if you go and study the history, he was taking shot not just at, you know, not just trying to clarify doctrine. He was taking shot at other church authorities in that book.
Yeah, and the Presbyterian's rather liberal approach to some things. He was bothered by it. And I'm not sure how much of it President McKay read, but he relied heavily on Elder Peterson. And if Elder Peterson was an arch conservative himself, if he was concerned about it, you know, it had to be a problem because he himself had strong views on doctrine and be a
conservative. Well, and it has been problematic for the church. The church before this 5 or 6 years ago, you know, they would try to downplay it. But the problem is it's quoted like everywhere. If you get the old manuals, and I'm not talking about really old, like 15-year-old manuals, yep. that they have like, they quote Mormon doctrine extensively.
And that was one of the few books you could use.
Right.
And the guide as a reference book. And to this day, the old guard who were raised on that find it still problematic. And I still use it because sometimes, you know, he marshals all the evidence here and there, and some of the things is useful. But a lot of questions come up that made it problematic. And the idea that he titled it Mormon doctrine is what bothered President McKay. You can't say this is Mormon doctrine. And the thing that shows you the kind of person President McKay was, he said, this book needs to be taken off the shelves, but if we come out publicly and have it repudiated, then you will never, ever be able to function as a journal authority ever again. Right. So we're not going to do that to you.
And not only that, they'd have to answer some difficult questions to say, because they've always played a little bit loose with why they don't like it. You have to read pretty deep to find out the doctrinal schisms, because that was one of the strengths of McKay, is to move away from the really problematic doctrines and keep them in the background. I think he did a lot of jujitsu when it came to like the issue of blacks in the priesthood, you know, and trying to punt that one down the line. And I think he was good at not being pinned down, as all great politicians are.
Well, and he also, as I mentioned, he didn't like confrontation, but he's also, I think Mike Quinn is right when he argues, talking about Clark and McKay. Clark was rational, methodical. President McKay was impulsive and spontaneous.
But that emotionality... Which, yeah, I think that's why I want to spend time talking about Bruce R. here, is because he was such a non-emotive authoritarian, and people really liked that. He would get up and say, he spoke ex cathedra. He spoke with the voice of God. And David O. McKay had such a softer approach that made people really love him, even though Bruce R. was beloved amongst people. You know, that I still listen to that talk, the seven deadly heresies, whatever it is, and you can just hear him talking as if he is dictating scripture, you know?
And this comes out in the new Arrington Diaries, where that talk referred to the seven deadly heresies and other things. He was rebuked by the quorum, but that never gets out publicly.
No, you know, we just have the talk.
But apparently he was really reamed out by the brethren on that. And so we have this kind of dichotomy of what really happened and what we think happened. And so we always are on the side of lack of confrontation. I think the problem with this deal of confrontation is they had enough of the Brown-Benson controversy that went public. And President Kate didn't like that at all. Mm-hmm. So I think Quinn makes a good argument that was the last time we ever let that happen publicly between members of the quorum.
That's true. They've been very good since then at keeping that under the lid. All right. So in the book, how many pages were the journals that you had to go through?
Well,
what's the volume of stuff you come through here?
It's tens of thousands of pages. I mean, and like I say, some of it's just photocopies of newspaper accounts, and some things, you know, where there were minutes of board meetings, which I found to be not really germane. I kind of glanced over everything. I tried to do this, all the important social, economic, political, theological, and ecclesiastical themes that made a difference for the modern church, I tried to include. And so I'm guessing that I probably worried about what to include, not include, for quite some time.
So you spent, I'm assuming, years working on this.
Yeah. And then when you get the final thing done, you wonder, did I... the question is, John, is this book that was out here, is this representational of President McKay?
Right.
If somebody read this, are they going to say, yep, I got that man pinned? Well, yes and no. I tried to be representational, but on the other hand, a lot of other things were going on in his life that he wrote about that didn't get in there, so... Is it representational? It's a hard question to answer.
So the first question I want to ask, you spent a lot of time climbing around in McKay's head. How did your perception of him change through this process?
Well, all the boyhood and early youth feelings about him just were enhanced. I mean, he was much more charismatic and wonderful than I thought. I mean, I always thought he was this man who could really put the gospel in human terms. But when you get to his diary, you see his humanity in ways that you would not see anywhere else. And that's what impressed me. His ability to relate to people, his lack of dogmatism, and his attempt to try and be as malleable as possible. However, he didn't bend on principle. There were certain things that he stood hard and fast with, but those were not nearly as much as others who have had that position. So in my mind, my image of him was only enhanced, and I came out thinking, you know, he was much better than I ever thought he was.
Wow. So, I mean, Greg Prince, we've talked about him a few times. He wrote the sort of the current definitive biography of David O. McKay about 10 years ago, I think.
Yeah, it's actually, people criticize Prince by saying it's not a great biography, but it's not a biography. It's a ministry of history of the McKay years. The biography of President McKay has not been written, and I wish it would be written.
Francis Gibbons. Claire Middlemess wrote one.
Huh?
Claire wrote one.
Well, yeah. We had a lot of Claire and his sons wrote these kind of traditional books that about his dad's experiences, and they are interesting, but they're not really biographical. And President McKay tried to keep diaries early on in his life, but like most of us, after January 15th, we stop.
And I think it's an interesting point to interject now. The brethren are not even allowed to do this anymore. They are prohibited from keeping journals, is what I've been told.
Well, this is one of the things that I just came across again in a website yesterday. That's the rumor. I don't know if it's true. I've heard pros and cons, and I would like to know. And Inquiring Minds would like to know.
Oh, yeah. So yeah, it's the only rumor. I haven't heard anything that I would say would officially validate.
Well, the fact that we don't have a lot of those diaries available, I think that in President McKay's case, his people were worried, well, boy, there's all kinds of sensitive stuff there. I found nothing that would be what I consider to be, with my perspective and my worldview, faith destroying. It's about a man with a prophetic office who tries to do the best he can, and mistakes are there. He has his biases, has his prejudices, but he tries to do the best he can, like all of us. So I felt better that if he has those kind of problems, maybe I am not so bad myself.
Well, I know the church critics and ex-Mormons, they're always looking for the smoking gun, and the faithful believers, they're always looking for the miraculous like sign. Neither of those things are very interesting to me, but was there anything in there from either camp that
I didn't find anything, even some of the quorum minutes that were put in the diary, unless they were heavily edited, I saw nothing there that was problematic. And of course today with the change of the Joseph Smith Project, other things coming out, these look rather tame. Maybe at the time that he died, had this come out, it would have been more problematic. But I don't find all these issues that people look at now. I was at a recent book signing where one person told me, "Yeah, he was a great guy, but he was a racist." And I says, "Well, define racist." And he said, "Well, you know, his inability to solve the race problem with the priesthood." And I have to get, as an historian, upset at the attempt of using presentism to go back and make evaluations. And President McKay's life raised that culture. I thought he made monumental strides towards understanding.
And I think Greg has done a great job. I don't know if it's in the book, I don't remember, or talks I've heard him give, of showing that he was a complex man who was very progressive on race in some ways, and some ways could be, you know, provincial and sort of a product of his time.
Yeah, and I guess the issue is, why do we expect religious leaders, Old Testament, New Testament, to be outside their culture?
Well, I think the critics would say because they're claiming to be prophets.
But. Well, that's the response to get, but then what about Peter? I mean, he couldn't get it with the Gentiles. He had to have Paul confront him.
Yeah, you're right.
I mean, he's the guy you should know. If anybody should know, he was on the Mount of Transfiguration. Yet he can't figure out the Gentiles should have a chance to hear the gospel. So I find that the cultural environment is powerful. And President McKay, you see that all the time with his views on some things that were so traditional. I couldn't expect him to make a monumental change.
The church is so young that I think we oftentimes mistakenly hold the leaders to such high standards. I was using this example before. It was something dealing with politics and corruption. And I was reading this thing about this emperor of China, who knows how, 700 years ago, who was just a terrible tyrant. And it's just part of their heritage. Tyrants come, tyrants go, we prevail. Same thing with the Catholic Church. There's been enough popes. There's been great ones. There's been terrible ones. And I don't think we've matured enough to realize that even if you accept that they're prophets and are led by God, they're still flawed human beings, even though we say it all the time.
And, I don't want to give that cliche again, because everybody's heard 1,000 times about infallibility with us and the Catholics.
Right.
But that's the problem. We claim they're fallible, but treat them as infallible. And President McKay was sensitive to that. You see in his diary, he comes out just a bit, this is something that we can't deal with, and I made a mistake. In fact, one of the things that shows his humanness is this man who tried to be forgiving and kind and the disciple of Christ and not have ill feelings towards people. I was wondering, how would he react to Fawn Brody? And so I came across this wonderful case in, I think it was 1954.
Well, and Brody was his cousin, no?
It was his niece.
And his niece, yeah. Yes, yes.
And so he writes in his diary that they were having a family reunion at Huntsville. And sure enough, who shows up but Fawn Brody and her husband. So he says, what am I going to do? Do I acknowledge her? So he went over and shook her hand, and he said it was tough for him. And I think it was Greg or somebody mentioned the fact that one of the problems was not so much the book, No Man Knows My History, but the fact that she thought that the impact of that book on the life of her father, his beloved brother Thomas, caused him to have a dirty death, a heart attack. And that's pretty stretched up, but he really believed that he caused his beloved brother all kinds of pain, and for that he couldn't forgive her. Although he did shake her hand and try not to be unfriendly, but it was hard for him.
But I mean, look at that model. Here you have Fawn Brody, and she made a national splash, and she caused the church a lot of stress. But here you have these two people, the prophet of the church, the highest, and they're there in Huntsville, like together as a family. I think it speaks to maybe a more gentle time.
Yeah, and to that effect, President McKay, in many ways, I think, had she not written the book, would be somewhat sympathetic towards her, because her father was, her father was kind of a tyrant, George H. Brimhall, and her mother was very liberal. And so Fawn was a very typical conservative Latter-day Saint until she went to school and began to expand her horizons. And her views were expansive. And I think President McKay would have liked to see that, but not the extent to which she took that.
Right.
Because he liked people who thought. I mean, the fact that he defended Stuart McMurrin against the quorum shows how much he respected the life of the mind and didn't want any kind of intellectual police on the church. And I thought it was admirable throughout his life. He defended those who did not adhere to the faith or had liberal views. Although he did say the man is entitled to his opinion, but he can't be employed at the church university with those kind of views because of other problems. So he was caught in a bind. He liked the freedom of the mind, but he realized he had certain restrictions he had to impose, which he probably was not happy with.
Hi, I'm Stephen Carter. My job is great. I get to gather the best articles, essays, stories, and poems from Sunstone Magazine and narrate them for the Sunstone Magazine podcast. It's the best of Mormonism in an audible quality recording. Some of the people Sunstone has published include D. Michael Quinn, Jana Reese, Gregory A. Prince, Elna Baker, Dan Weatherspoon, Gina Colvin, and John Gustav Rathal. Head over to patreon.com/sunstone to listen to some of our free episodes. And then, join us for the best of Mormon thought and experience.
Believer or not, I think being president of the Mormon Church has to be one of the hardest jobs on the planet. Because you have all this baggage around what it means to be a prophet, seer, and revelator. But you're in the real world functioning with a real corporation, a real organization.
And he was well aware of that problem. And he was not one to be overly impressed with the job he had. He was humbled by it. And assertion made, I think it's probably true. I think Mike Quinn brought it up a couple of times, that President McKay liked to be lionized. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true. The white suits and the hair and the schismatic nature. And he liked in front of the camera, and he liked to be, I think, appreciated, not vain or...
Well, I always think about the photo ops, you know, when temples were being built, and he'd always be out there with the gold shovel smiling at the cameras. And
to show how much this meant to him, the persona he tried to project, there's a wonderful incident, which I don't have in the diary because it didn't really pertain to anything. It was in Wilkes' diary where in later years he was coming for a visit on the campus and he was in a wheelchair then. He had a recent stroke. So President Wilkes says, well, I want to get you out here, President McKay, and take you around this new building we're doing here. I think you'll really like it. Let's get out of the car. And he says, no. He says, well, why? And his wife says, President McKay, honey, let's get out of the car. I'm not going to allow any student here at this campus to see me in a wheelchair.
Huh.
I will not allow that to happen. And his wife was rather upset they didn't get out. But that, in some ways, shows he had this certain stance, I want to project this image, and I'm not going to do anything that would impair that at all. So he was very conscious of that. And in his later years, he was very conscious of his loss of memory. And he always wanted to do the right thing, but he was always fearful that he might lose this persona that he had created.
So what other things in the diary struck you as you were going through about the man?
Well, I guess this nice guy image, one of my favorite stories, which I put the whole incident in the book. Usually I would truncate long entries, but this was so impressive, the one where he... was down in his office when a Protestant minister from Salt Lake came to visit him, and because it was his birthday too. So when he got back to the office, President McKay was told by Claire, so-and-so came by to see you, said it was his birthday too. He says, who is this guy? Find his address and cancel my meetings. So he got in his car and drove down to some apartment in Salt Lake City, walked up five flights of stairs, and this guy's in his 80s, knocks on the door and says, I'm sorry I missed you, I'm President McKay. Please come in. So I talked about things, and then at the end of the meeting, the minister says, President McKay, could I give you a blessing? He says, I'd love to have a blessing for you. So he sat in a chair and got a blessing, and McKay says, could I give you one? It would be an honor.
Wow.
I mean, who thinks that would happen today? I mean, just a wonderful example of the human nature of him, how he would do things to all kinds of people. It didn't matter who they were. He would always try to be kind and friendly and pretty outgoing, which I think is, I don't see President Grant doing that or anybody else, but that was who he was. And he was also visited by many prominent people throughout the world. And oddly enough, presidents of the United States really liked him. Lyndon B. Johnson, who was the antithesis of President McKay in every way, invited him back to Washington for counsel. I need your help. He would be flying back from California and say to the pilot, pull down to Salt Lake. I want to see my good friend, President McKay. He'd just pull out of the air down the airport, go see President McKay, express how much he appreciated him. And Eisenhower the same way. He got invited to stag parties at the White House with President Eisenhower. And people just liked him. They found him to be, and according to one account, that when he went to this party at the White House, he was the life of the party. So he was a man who could fit in anywhere and really kind of projected this image of wholesome humanity.
Did McKay have any dealings with Jack Anderson then, since we're talking about Washington?
You know, I don't think that there were some articles, I think, that appeared in newspaper accounts that might have been put in the diary by Claire, but no one-on-one encounters that I can recall. It could have. The ones that I did use, all the entries, could have. I don't recall anything in particular about him. And he was usually treated fairly by the press, and he liked the press, and the press liked him.
Yeah. So what things do you think that he struggled with the most as you've read through these years? What were the biggest things weighing on
McKay? Well, he, I think that the correlation program that was begun in the early 60s, he was very afraid of losing the individual, the church.
He was right.
But yeah, he was. But on the other hand, he was struck by the fact this church is just ballooning. We have no way to control what's happening in the world and new converts and the growth of the church. We've got to get our handle on this because without some kind of control, we just can't make this work. And he was reluctant to have this kind of central control. And I think had he been perhaps a little more alert and had more years, he might have refined President Lee's correlation program because he wasn't in favor of taking away the individual.
It was a tough thing. I speak wistfully of that time, you know, in the 70s when especially if you were in Utah, there was so much cultural richness, you know, state camps and just culture and theater and all that kind of stuff. But you're right. You imply that they were faced with the problem of growth, and growth was pretty heady in these days. And how do you keep reproducing that thing that had been built over 120 years out into the world?
And without structural changes, and you'll find in the diary where all these meetings were held about how to cope with this, how to cope with that. And the number of letters that came in from bishops and stake presidents saying, you know, what are we going to do here? We got this problem we can't contain. What do you suggest we do? And it was a constant attempt to try and grapple with growth. And I think he was unhappy we had to make compromises.
And I don't pretend to know what the solution would have been. I mean, it's
I don't
a complicated
either. Thing. Had we left every stake and ward to itself, when you have 28,000 branches, it would have gone crazy.
Yeah, we have however many, 300 branches of the restoration, there would have been 900.
As well as the situation where it's a no-win situation.
Right. So what lessons are in here for us today, do you think?
Well, one, I think, is that change is inevitable. And although we have change in the church and American history in the 20s and 30s and 40s, the change was so gradual, you don't perceive it. But after the Second World War and the growth and the change in culture and society, we have to cope with change. And we got to make decisions that will best hold our traditional views and our theology, but yet accommodate the culture. And I think that President Kimball and President Hinckley took up that torch, others not so much. So if I have to, you know, rank the 20th century, I think President McKay started out, and upon his shoulders, President Kimball and President Hinckley stood. He kind of paved the way for that different look at how to do things. Whereas under the short term of President Lee and President Benson, and unfortunately, the short term of Howard W. Hunter, we didn't have that sense of mission and expansion. I think that President McKay started that. He was the first one that really realized that we need to cope with change and get out there and meet the public. And I think that President Hinckley, even more than President Kimball, was like President McKay. He loved the press, and he sought to do things. And in many ways, they projected the image that we're going to make this, despite the changes, we'll cope. And that coping has been hard. It's still hard today.
Well, I think definitely he's the man who created the modern church. And you know, Hinckley took it and ran with it. But had it not been for him, who knows, it could have just descended into obscurity.
Yeah, and you wonder about the seniority, you know, but George F. Richards was next in line, and he dies, I think, in 1950. President McKay had, I didn't know this, he had ill health when he was a counselor. And had he gone then, and you had George F. Richards as president of the church, a great man, but it'd be that old tradition of the kind of the patriarchs, you know, this Smiths and the Richards. So President K was really a break. And so what I see from him is a substantial break. And like you just mentioned, without him, the modern church would not be what it is today. He was basically the the founder of the modern church. And he didn't solve all the problems, but at least he addressed the issues that we had to confront. And you often wonder, you know, it's not good to be counterfactual when you try and speculate, what if? But one wonders, what if? I mean, he became president at age 77. And had he been as rigorous and vigorous earlier on, what might he have done?
Right.
That's just speculation. You can't ever go with what if.
Of course. Well, any last thoughts on the book?
Well, I think that it provides a window through which you can see how the modern church evolved and how the post-war society demanded we look at everything. And President McKay did look at everything. And I think that by reading these diaries, you'll see a man for almost 20 years who steered the course in every possible way. And I think that, like you mentioned initially, he's been forgotten as a mover and shaker. We think about the recent leaders, but he's the one that set it in motion, in my opinion.
Well, excellent. Thank you so much for putting this book together. I think it is an important addition to the canon of books that we really need to understand the church. And of course, we've talked about what a great and influential man he was. So the title now, this was published in January, I believe.
Yes.
Confidence Amid Change, The Presidential Diaries of David O. McKay, 1951 and 1970. Of course, you are Harvard Heath, who edited over a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. Published by Signature Books. It's available at all of our fine booksellers here in Utah. You can get it on Amazon and wherever else you find books.
Well, thank you, John. I appreciate it.
It's been wonderful talking to you. And again, I appreciate you bringing light and the humanity of this great man who shaped who we are today. All right. Well, thanks, everybody. You can contact me at johnlarson@sunstone.org. Harvard, if anyone wants to reach out to you, how can they get a hold of you?
Email is hsheath@hotmail.com. That's one word, hsheath@hotmail.com.
Fantastic. I enjoyed it a lot. Thank you, Harvard.